The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Shall we come to order now? As we finish up our time, I've been trying to highlight, as we've looked at the Anabaptist Radical Reformation movement, the influences that have come into the American context that have created our nation. And I'm going to be unashamedly modern age and early American discussion at this point, because it's election day and I've been thinking about all this and it all comes together. So forgive me, and hopefully you won't be upset that it's not totally reformational. But I think the first thing that I want you to think about is that when you come to the end of the Reformation period, one of the profound recognitions was that creed had caused profound destabilization. Remember, we said that creeds were developed to create diplomatic relationships. This was a governmental tool as well as a theological tool. It was bringing states together. And the religious wars of religion, which in a real sense is an oxymoron. Religion is supposed to tie people together, religio. Instead, here's a war. They're tearing each other apart. They said it's creeds. The Lutherans can't get along with the Reformed. We finally got to Westphalia. We got the Catholics, the Reformed, and the Lutheran all together, but the Anabaptists have no place. They're still being persecuted. So what are we going to do? And everybody is going to look at these Unitarian types and see them as dangerous. So this created a whole new spirit. There were two developments that we want to keep in mind. One is the totally rationalist model that will come out of Descartes. You know, it's been said, I think, therefore I am. And you compare that with I am that I am. You know, God says, I'm God. I think, in a certain sense, if you want to spiritualize it, man saying, I'm God. One of the great insights of the discovery of the solar-centric view of our worlds was that man was dethroned. He's no longer the center of the universe. But in discovering that, man said, it was my reason that discovered it. By dethroning myself, I enthroned myself even higher, because it's my reason that figured it out. Okay? So while I'm not central, my mind figured out. So mind becomes the standard. It's reason and logic. And you'll find Kant, for example, in his work on what is enlightenment, he'll say enlightenment is daring to know. Dare to know, dare to reason. Throw off all the tutelage and imposed standards of creed and revelation and use your mind. And so what will happen then is that men are going to try to wrestle with what kind of world can we establish post-Westphalia that will have peace, that will not force on people religious creed anymore. And so we'll have the Enlightenment spirit that will say, get rid of religion, it's dangerous. We must use simply our reason and establish the new moral order. Okay? That is one model, and many people have said the American context is really the Enlightenment coming to its own. Now, on the other hand, we must remember there was another variety of reason that was in the air, and that was a reason that was willing to say that reason and revelation are not necessarily antithetical. And I'd like to coin a phrase for the sake of this discussion and speak of it as the Christian Enlightenment. Now, in a Vantillian context, we understand that Bantil would argue that enlightenment, human reason, can scarcely be Christian if it's autonomous. Okay, I want to affirm that. But I want to say, in the mind of the people of this era, following a man like John Locke, okay, I want to talk about John Locke for a moment. John Locke, most of us know, is the great political scientist that our founders in America read as they developed their thinking on government. He was very widely known, widely read, widely quoted. In fact, in the Declaration of Independence, when it says life, liberty, and originally Jefferson said property, he was just quoting Locke. That's right out of Locke. It was changed to the pursuit of happiness, because the idea that every man had a right to property was problematic, given the fact that property required a certain amount of wealth and ownership, and that was pretty egalitarian. They were not prepared to say that. Happiness in that context included not just personal happiness, but ultimately eternal blessedness. It had a religious cast as well, the idea of having happiness with God. But be that as it may, Locke, we must understand, reflected a certain spirit which we could call a sort of Protestant Thomism. Now, what do we mean by that? Do you remember St. Thomas's view? He said, I can go a long way with my reason to get to God. Eventually, I'm going to run out of gas, and I'm going to have to say, I need revelation. Now, not everybody's brilliant like me. Not everybody's a philosopher, says Thomas. So there's the imbecile and the common uneducated man who doesn't have the time to do this. So he'll go to the Bible right away, and that's fine. That's why God gave us the Bible. But, you know, we don't need all the Bible. We can do a lot with reason, because reason and the Bible are complementary. They work together. Now, see, when you think about this, this is what the common sense philosophy that comes from Scotland and England in this post-Reformational era is going to say. It's going to say that reason will take you where the Bible goes, and the Bible will take you where reason goes. They are friends. True reason is going to take you to Scripture. A true understanding of Scripture is going to take you to reason. Now, that's kind of a naive optimism, isn't it, living at this point in history? But that was in the air, and that was believed. It was called the common sense philosophy. And this is the sort of thinking that you'll find that was at work with many of our early founders following in the Lockean tradition. Locke wrote a book called The Reasonableness of Christianity. He said, look, Christianity is reasonable. In fact, when Timothy Dwight, one of the great launchers of the Second Great Awakening in America, professor up in New England of theology, I think he was the president of Yale, he will write a book called The Triumph of Infidelity in America. And it will talk about all the Enlightenment thinkers that have come into our context. And he will say, thankfully, there are many who have resisted this spirit, such as John Locke, one of the brilliant Christian scholars. He understood Locke as a Christian, not an Enlightenment thinker. And that's why I proposed the phrase, the Christian Enlightenment. Okay? Now, what do we mean by this? Well, basically, Locke will write to a friend and say, the Bible is inerrant and inspired. Everything you want to know about God is right there in the Bible. He'll write commentaries on the Pauline epistles. He's committed to the Bible. And yet he can set the whole biblical literature aside and do a whole analysis of government and never refer to the Bible at all, because he's operating in this common sense philosophy that logic and reason will take you to where the Scriptures are, and the Scriptures will take you to where logic and reason are. They're one and the same. They flow together. And so the Christian Enlightenment of our founders then believed that we could start in a neutral point and come out with a government that would be good for the human spirit, that wouldn't put the creed in the face of people. Now, how do they do that? Well, first of all, I think it's important to understand that they recognized that each of the states that were coming together to create this new commonwealth in the wake of the struggles with England had a religious perspective one way or another. Either they had been founded, like Pennsylvania, without a state church, but were called upon to have Christian leaders, or they were consciously Anglican, like Virginia, or they may have been congregational, like Massachusetts, etc. So there were various viewpoints of theology that were already embedded in the states. And their viewpoint was, we'll never get together if we have a church, a state that has a creed, but we don't have to. We can have a common sense government that will reflect the principles of the spirit that we all share of Christianity by establishing a rational system. And so the way they did that was by affirming, first of all, the notion of providence. Okay? Providence is the belief that God is superintending in history, that God is personally at work. And I want to argue this. No deist believes in providence in that sense of a God who's active in history. The notion of deism at bottom is not only is there no revelation from God, God has not spoken, but God by and large is unconcerned with human history. So that prayer is really irrelevant. Why would you pray to a God who's not going to answer? There's a God who's a creator, a God that you must affirm as a first principle, but a God who's involved in history, that's irrational. We reject that. But he's a God who's the first mover, the prime mover. The Christian Enlightenment did not take that model. Instead, it said, there is a God who is active in history. I want to give you what I would say is a dramatic proof of what I've just claimed, that none of our founders were deists in the classical sense of deism, that is a rejection of God's involvement in history. And you hear it all the time, all of our founders were deists. I want to give you, if you took a triumvirate of three key men who said they all had to be deists, would it not be Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams? Three great men. You'd say, wow, these are great guys. Did you know there was a committee of the Continental Congress that was established to put together the great American seal, the The idea was that you can't have any official document for international purposes unless it has the seal of our government. We need a seal. Charles Thompson, the first clerk of the Continental Congress, asked that this would be established. Now, Charles Thompson, by the way, lived in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. That's where I pastor. And his farm is called Harriton. And Harriton High School is on his farm. There's the Baptist church there in Bryn Mawr that actually was donated by Charles Thompson because he was a Presbyterian elder. He used to have to travel down to Middletown. He couldn't get there all the time. So he let the Baptists build a church on his property where he worshipped when he couldn't travel. By the way, he was a biblical scholar. He translated the whole Septuagint into English. He said, I'll give you an English translation of the Septuagint, which we can know from correspondence that George Washington said he read part of it because Charles Thompson sent it to him. He said, I've enjoyed reading your work. So amazing. He was a biblical scholar. Now, what's fascinating at this point is that Charles Thompson said, we need the seal. The Continental Congress established a committee of three, and on that committee were Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. Now, that's a pretty important cast of American characters. Do you know what their recommendation for the Great Seal of America was? We can read this in the records of the Continental Congress. It was to be Moses with his rod outstretched over the parted sea, with Israel safely crossed, the waves collapsing on the Egyptian army, with the phrase, disobedience to tyrants is obedience to God. Now you stop and think about just for a moment of that picture. If you're wanting to find the most undeistic notion in history, it would be the parting of the Red Sea by Moses' rod, and the saying that God was the one who was spared. Now you can see the imagery. It's the Great Sea that's protected America from the tyrant, and he's protected us as he did his ancient people. The idea of providence was built into that seal. In fact, it's built into the very Declaration of Independence. It says that we pledge our honor, our fortunes, with a firm reliance on divine providence. That's what our founders said. They believed in providence. And you can go through the language and the history of our early founders, and you'll discover that the way they tried to put it together was that while we will not define a creed as a government, we are all believers in a God who's working in history on our benefit, on our behalf, a God that we affirm in our enabling document as we declare our independence, and then beyond that, that we are going to capture ultimately in the seal that will be part of our nation. Now, you all know what the seal is. I'm not going to make you take out a dollar bill out of your pocket and look at it now, but if you want to, you can. And I might pass an offering plate, but I'd be careful. I'm a pastor, so be really careful. You know, I could grab it from you, all right? But I won't. If you look at the seal, you'll see a couple things that are very fascinating. On the left side of the seal, which is the back side of the seal, it will have the Latin phrase at the top, annuit coeptus, okay? And then on the bottom side, it will say, novus ordo seculorum. You'll see a pyramid that has, it's incomplete, it has 13 courses of stone. At the bottom, in Roman numerals, it'll say 1776. At the top, in proportion, you'll see a triangle with an eye in it, with a radiance that circulates around that, right under the phrase. Do you see that? Okay, now what I want you to note is that, first of all, at the bottom, when it says Novus Ordo Seclorum, it says there's a new order of the ages. Something new has happened in history. Now, one of the high points of my career as a social activist, okay, I had the opportunity to do an invocation at the Betsy Ross House on Flag Day about 4 or 5 years ago, and the speaker of the day was retired Chief Justice Warren Burger. So that was an honor. I knew someone that had me in that place. I got to give the prayer, and I was thinking about the politically incorrect character of the prayer I was going to give. I said, I'm a Christian. This is not the right time to praise a Christian. Well, I got to praise a Christian, so what am I going to do? So I said, I'm going to pray a historical prayer. And if anybody gets mad at me, I'll say, I'm just praying our history. You're censoring history? What's wrong with you? Right? So I wanted to turn the tables. And so what I did is I found one of the early prayer proclamations from the Continental Congress, and I used it. It's very Christian. It talks about praying that the knowledge of Christ would cover the earth like the waters cover the sea. That's right in our history. Do you know that? And when I was done with that, having heard Chief Justice Warren Burger saying, you know, there's this great book called The Miracle in Philadelphia. He said, it was a miracle. That's what he said. For 13 independent sovereign nations to come together to create one nation without war, to simply acquiesce, to create a League of Nations, said it's never happened since, it had never happened before, it'll probably never happen again. It's a new order of the age, something unlike it, freely banding together in a common civil jurisdiction in peace. Think how hard it is just to get the euro dollar on the market. This is a whole nation of 13 sovereign nations coming together to create one. Now, I prayed that prayer, and he said, "Where in the world did you get that prayer? I've never heard that before." And it was my honor to say, "No, sir, there are about 10 of these I found in the Continental Congress records, and they're all just as Christian as the others. So would you please send me those? I'd like to have them." So that was a high water. I got to teach a little bit of the gospel to the Chief Justice of the United States. Now, what's really exciting as you look at that, it's called the Miracle in Philadelphia. Do you know that George Washington said it's a miracle that we could get a constitution? James Madison said this is a miracle. On the floor of the Continental Congress, Alexander Hamilton said, "We have to approve this constitution because it was a miracle that got us here, and we are fools to appeal to future miracles that God may not give us." You know, that's American history. I'm not making any of this up. Okay, this is all true. Now, at that point, as they were appealing to God's special intervention in history, they finally came up with the seal, and Charles Thompson selected the words that are at the top, "Annuit coeptus." That's there. Take a look. You can see it. They're still there. By the way, the dollar bill is going to be disappearing over the next few years, so save one for posterity, okay, because they're turning them into metal dollars that has Pocahontas on the front. Okay, they want to get rid of the paper dollar. I don't know if they want to get rid of the theology there or not, but at any rate, the seal will still stand, I hope. Charles Thompson said he loved that phrase. He had found it in Virgil. He was a classic scholar as well as a biblical scholar. And he said the words mean, "Annuit coeptus, he has smiled or nodded on our undertakings." That's what that Latin phrase means. And now notice it's immediately above a triangle with an eye in it. Now through the years growing up, I used to hear people say this is an Illuminati symbol. You know, this is a symbol of a clandestine group of Masons that wanted to overthrow America and all that sort of thing. Well, I was really delighted when I was in England a few years ago in the Westminster Abbey to see an ancient church window that has it. And I bought a book there on Christian iconography. And they said, this is an ancient Christian symbol of the Trinitarian view of God the Father. Okay? And as I read that and looked at it, I went back to the record in the Continental Congress. The journal still exists. You can go back and read it if you want. And it says this, "The words and the eye of providence in the triangle," that's what it says, "are here to remind us of," quote, "God's signal interpositions of providence on behalf of the American cause." So there was this idea that God is a God of providence who's intervened on behalf of our nation, who's brought us into existence, and that this eye represents God, and that it is God's providence that's at work. Okay? Now, I could go on. I don't want to go any further than that. Just to note that, first of all, if deism is defined as the absentee landlord view of God, who is the first cause, the creator, and then abandoned everything, that is absolutely contrary to the express visible symbol and words of the beginning of this nation. Now, notice, I did not say this is distinctively Christian, although that is a Trinitarian symbol. When the United States concluded its great debate with the Revolution, England and America signed the peace treaty, and it says, "In the name of the undivided Trinity, God's providence having disposed both the king and the American people to have peace." So the Trinitarian and providential notions are clearly tied in our history. Now, why am I trying to say this? I'm trying to argue that while I don't like John Locke's apologetic, the idea of the common sense philosophy, he was a Christian. And he was appealed to on his providential grounds for the formation of the American government. So that when John Witherspoon, the first great American Presbyterian president of Princeton, formalized the first General Assembly, he said, "We do appeal to the common reason of people for our polity and government, that we will submit it to the common judgment." He believed in the common sense model. Now what we find then is this. Our constitutional government was committed to the idea that God is a God of providence, that he governs over all the nations, and that each state was to seek its own way to express its faith in that common unity of a belief in a transcendent God. America was a theistic nation from the beginning. Its federal principle said, "We will have no test of religion. We will not require you to take any view of religion for civil office." And that is why, I've noted earlier, when the leader of the Senate and the President of the United States takes the oath of office, he may swear or affirm. They were trying to protect whether you're an Anabaptist or you are Reformed and could take an oath. They said, "We're not going to take a position on this. This is for either way." Why is this important? Well, to me, it's important because the whole opposition to the presence of faith in government is inconsistent with the founding of our nation. I did not once claim that America is a Christian nation. I did claim that Pennsylvania was consciously started this way. In fact, I can buttress it a little bit stronger with this. In 1774, when there was going to be the Committee of Commissioners gathering together to talk about what are we going to do with the problem with England, the Pennsylvania State House had to decide how will we send delegates to discuss this with other members from all the other colonies that are coming together. And they required an oath. And this oath is recorded again in history. It was also required in the state of Delaware, which used to be part of Pennsylvania at one point in history. The southern three colonies was what, or counties they were called. It said this, you had to put in your name, I blank do believe in God the Father, God the Eternal Son, God the Holy Spirit, one God in three persons, and that the Bible is inspired by God. If you could not take that test of religion, you could not represent Pennsylvania at that constitutional gathering or preparation for what would become the United States and its independence. And Benjamin Franklin had to take that oath. Do you realize that? He had to swear that, and he did. Now, did he do it with tongue in cheek? I don't know. He called himself a Protestant, by the way. He actually wrote a revision of the Book of Common Prayer so that the layperson could pray more effectively. When he was getting ready to travel internationally, he pleaded with his daughter to be faithful in her worship for her spiritual well-being. When Thomas Paine wrote his book, The Age of Reason, he submitted it to Benjamin Franklin to consider publishing. And you know what he said? He said, it's not good for man to spit in the wind. He said, you're spitting in the wind of our culture. You ought to burn this book rather than have it printed. Now, wait a second. This is Benjamin Franklin now. The great book on deism that you hear about all the time and that you'll read anywhere in American history. So this is what our founders believe. Benjamin Franklin. And I've got this all in print. This is all original writings. It's all there. He said, burn it. And he was a printer. He loved to print. He was the guy that advocated paper money in the first place. It would be great for the printing press. He said, burn this book. Today, if you go into our historic sites down to Independence Hall and you walk through the places where the bookstores are selling books, you will find the book, The Age of Reason, publicly displayed, which is a book that kept Thomas Paine from being buried in a cemetery in his hometown. They said, we can't let this guy be buried, this unbeliever, with the rest. He was a deist. He was not welcomed in his own town's graveyard. The book that made him famous was Common Sense, not The Age of Reason. Common Sense cried out to fight in the revolution, but that book has been discarded. The book that develops the preparation for atheism is enshrined. It's in all our public places. This is a travesty of history. One of the things that I'm arguing now, and I want to say this on a reform basis because I know I'm swimming against the stream, but I don't care. I like to be an odd man out. I'm trying to tell you that the historical evidence proves that America had a reformed understanding of God, although did not desire to be explicitly Christian in its federal government. It said, we will believe in the providence of Almighty God. It's enshrined in our great seal. It's enshrined in our great document. It's at the core of our thinking. I can go through all of our founders, and you'll see that they all believed in the providence of God in some sense. Even Thomas Jefferson, in his two inaugural addresses, will appeal to the providence of God. Just like God led his ancient people in Israel, so he's led these people by his providential aid. That's Jefferson I'm quoting from his second inaugural address. So what I would like to argue then is that America was born not out of the Enlightenment, but it was born out of the Christian Enlightenment. That's different. It affirmed the fact that God is relevant for history, that God's word is central, that faith and government ought to be friendly allies, but there should be no imposition of one upon the other. That was the hybridization of the Reformed and the Radical Reformation that created America. Freedom of conscience and a system that had the rule of law under the authority of God and his providential care. Now, as I conclude, and I'll be glad to take any questions, comments, or disagreements on any of this, I think it's fascinating that when General George Washington stands up at the Continental Congress, I mean now it's come to the Constitutional Convention, as he's presiding, he said, the matter is now in the hands of God. That's how he begins it. He said, we're committing this whole thing to God. In the middle, 6 weeks in, when there's a huge debate and they're not getting anywhere, Benjamin Franklin's speech is written out. It's recorded by James Madison in his minutes of the Constitutional Convention. He said that if an empire is going to rise, can it possibly rise without God's aid if he's the one that causes the sparrow to fall and counts the hairs on our head? We need to be praying. He called for a day of prayer and said, we need to pray every day. This is Franklin, praying that God would help the Constitutional Convention so that it would get its work done. And when George Washington is finally elected, when he is elected, he stands up as his very first oath of office. He will say, I do solemnly swear to uphold the Constitution. And then he adds the word, so help me God. You know, those are not in the Constitution. He added those. They're said by every president since. And when he did it, he bowed down and he kissed the Bible. He did not just put his hand on the Bible. He kissed the Bible, which was the way when you were a Christian in the Anglican tradition, affirming the common law, you said, I submit myself to Christ by kissing his word. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry against you. You kissed the word. He didn't just put his hand on it. He kissed it. And then when he gave his first address, you know what he said? It is very appropriate on this first public occasion when I speak that I would recognize the almighty rule of God's providence that brought us to this point. He said, it's the very, and his last word is again an appeal to God's providential care. Now, where did Washington learn his providence? This is the last story, and then I'm done. It's all good for Election Day, in my opinion. This is the kind of stuff, you can throw it all out, but I can prove it all from history, okay? I've got historical basis for everything I'm saying. Some places, this much behind it. I've researched stuff for 15 years. Okay, what's amazing now is that Washington, as a young colonel going out to the Virginia-Pennsylvania frontier, had fought with the Indians. And you may know that outside of Pittsburgh, there was a great battle where General Braddock was defeated. He went out fighting in the British manner, with all the men fighting, standing side by side. The Indians were all hiding. They're just picking off these guys. You know, the ratio was 10 to 1. The British Army couldn't see one of the Indians, and they were just killing them one after another. The only person that had any wisdom was Washington, who had been an Indian surveyor, out with the Indians and all these things through the years. And a general who was there met him some 15 years later. So the year is about 1770. Washington was going back to the frontier because he was to be paid in land, as well as his soldiers were having fought in the battle. And as a surveyor, he knew if you got the wrong piece of property, it could be a swamp. And he wanted to make sure that whatever land he and his friends got were really good lands. So he was traveling out west, and the word got out that there was a party of Easterners going out into Indian country and a band of Indians. Now, this is Native Americans coming, okay? This is a group of people who came to him, and this is the word that was recorded by his best friend, the man that was with him when he died, the man that was the Surgeon General of the United States Army in the Revolution. So this is not a slouch. It's also recorded by Washington's adopted grandson, who tells it and said, I heard it many times through the years from the people that were close to my grandfather. And it was this. This Indian sat down and said, I was here in this wilderness with you 15 years earlier. And when I was here, I saw that you fought like an Indian, and I asked all of my braves to shoot only at you. And he said, after 15 rounds of firing only at you and being unable to kill you, I told them to stop. I said, this man is destined by the Great Spirit to lead a mighty nation, and let him be. That's a true story from history. Do you know that? Have you ever heard that before? Maybe you've heard it and you're lucky. I never heard it until a few years ago as I was reading through an ancient play. This was actually turned into a play. It was shown in Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. in the 1800s, composed by Washington's grandson. What's fascinating is that when this story had occurred, when Washington was there in his early years, he wrote back to his half-brother, I think it's John Augustine Washington, he said, quote, by a miracle of providence, my life has been spared. Two horses were shot out from under me. My coat has bullet holes in it, and my hat was shot off my head. But the reports of my death are premature. They had a little sense of humor there. But that's, and you know, they've gone back and excavated outside of that area, and they found a button some years ago that had GW on it. They've proven his story. His button was found there around where the Indian battle occurred. Now, that story is fascinating. I said, who can believe that? Well, you need to know two other things. One of the future, I think it's, I'm a little blanking on the name of the pastor now, but from Virginia, who will later become a president of Princeton. When this all happened, as a Presbyterian minister, he preached a sermon, and he said, Samuel Davies was his name, I just remember now. Reverend Davies preached, and he said, we can only hope that Providence has spared young Colonel Washington for some future signal service on behalf of his nation. Now, that was a Presbyterian who said that. Okay, an Indian chief says it years later. Now, in the middle of the Revolutionary War, this is at the Battle of Monmouth now, and this is recorded in the recollections of General Washington by his grandson, who said he had talked with all the various people who knew his grandfather and the stories he had heard. He simply was recording them. He said the battle occurred after a war gathering had happened the night before. All the generals, including the Surgeon General Samuel Craik, who had traveled in the West and had reported the story about the Indian chief, General Washington stepped out. The commanders of war were all there, and he said, I want to tell you something that I saw and heard when I was with General Washington in the woods some years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. And he told the story. And he said, Scotch-Irish Presbyterian that I am, I don't believe in Indian prophecies typically. But I believe this is true. I don't believe that General Washington will ever die in battle. God has a plan for him. This sounds like hagiography, doesn't it? I'm telling you, this is recorded in American history. I'm underscoring, it's true. It's there. The thing is that the next day the battle happens, an artillery shell explodes right by the soldiers, the commanding officers who were just getting ready to go out, and Washington was there. The smoke went up, and they looked, and his clothing were all rearranged. Dust was all over the place. And everybody looked at Surgeon General Craik, who went like this. That's a true story. He said, God has a plan for this man. Now, throw that all out if you want. That is recorded in American annals in the kind of historical documents that we accept for any other field of study, except we won't want to believe this. Our founders believed that God had a unique purpose in American history. Now, I don't say that America ever was a Christian nation. I'm not saying it was perfect. We've sinned profoundly. We've still sinned profoundly. But I do want to say this, that God did something unique when he brought this nation into being. You know what he did? He gave us the chance to have freedom of religion, to pursue him with the depths of our conscience, and that had never happened any place in the world. And you know, God did say long ago, if you have covenant theology, I will bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you. America has chosen to bless the Christian faith and say, you have freedom here. Is there any other country that has been blessed like we have? One of the things I bring back every time I travel internationally is I'm so glad to be home. We have such, the worst of us are blessed here. We have a gift from God, not just material, the freedom to worship. And I think God had that in mind when he gave us this country. He did something special. Our founder said, providence is blessed upon it. And you know, it was because America had the opportunity to take the good ideas of enemies and make them work together. The Anabaptists were being killed by the Reformed. In America, they agreed with each other, and look what we have. Is it perfect? No. Is there anything better anywhere else? Not that I know of. And I want to say, I don't want to lose sight of the providential view that God has done something special. In fact, the last act of Abraham Lincoln before he was assassinated was to sign the bill that said, we shall have In God We Trust on our American coinage. I think it was a gift of God. All right, you want to shoot me down? God's providence protected Washington. I can dodge a few bullets too. Okay, go ahead. Questions, comments, or we can conclude. I hope you go out and vote at least today. Absentee ballot. Back. Go ahead. What relation should there be between state and church? I would say the following. I am very, very glad there is a government that does not have a test of religion. The Bible never says, as far as I can see it, what kind of government a state must establish. There's wisdom in Israel's government, but that's expired, along with the civil polity thereof, and binds us no more than the general equity of that nation, so as our creed tells us in the Westminster Confession. So we're not obliged to follow anything. I think God left government now for the dictates of prudence and reason and submission to the general principles of his morality. I think whatever government we ought to establish should be one that will allow the faith of Christianity to be free. That should seem to be the minimum, whatever it is. And if that requires that other religions need to have freedom, I'm not opposed to that, because Christianity doesn't need the state to prove its truth. It didn't need it in the ancient church. It doesn't need it today. But a state that's hostile to Christianity is inconsistent with the Bible. That would be my fundamental state. So clearly state and church have to be distinct. I would argue that they ought to be friendly allies. I don't mind the metaphor that Jefferson developed of the separation of church and state by a wall. I just think the wall ought to be low enough so that we can communicate with each other. You know, the state ought to be over there, the church ought to be over here, and we ought to be able to communicate and say, no, you don't give me a civil polity as the church. Stay away. We build up our own government over here. And the church needs to say, don't tell us what our creed is. This is what we believe. But now let's walk along with neighbors on the different side, working together where we can and where we can't, and say, that's your way and this is my way. But respect the freedom and rights for both. So I like the phrase better, the distinction of church and state, rather than the separation. They are distinct spheres. So the person can work in both sides and work together for the best interests of their own ends without corrupting the other. The way that worked out in the initial setting, I think, was brilliant, which was the federal system, which said each state has the right to define its government and its religious character, and that the next state can be different. And yet, on a higher level, we'll all agree together in a common, uniform system of governing ourselves in league. That was a good model. That had worked in Switzerland between Protestant and Catholic cantons. They had figured out how to do that. They tried to do that here. It worked well until the 14th Amendment was reinterpreted later on in the 20th century to say that the First Amendment no longer belongs just to the states. It belongs to all of us now, and we can redefine what civil and religious liberties are. Supreme Court took that federalism away from us, and I think that's been the danger. So the early federalism, I think, was a brilliant model. Was it perfect? No, but it's about as best as we're going to get. And to the extent we can move away from the encroachments of the federal government on the states, I think it's a good thing. So this is how radical I am. Okay. Now, you may not agree with me. You don't have to agree with anything I've said, in fact. Go study it yourself. But I don't have any problem with a Mormon state or a Jewish state or a Catholic state or a Presbyterian state as long as it recognizes the right of conscience of each person within its community. It says, you can't make me pay for this established religion. You can't make me worship in it. You can't take away my rights to serve in government. But if you want to have a government and schools and that reflect this heritage, as long as you're fair, then that's fine. That was our early heritage. I'm comfortable with that personally. So if I were in New York and they said, we're going to be a Jewish state, all I would ask is let me be a Christian here. If you want to have, you know, celebrate Jewish holidays when you're off rather than Christian holidays here, that's okay with me. Just let me be a Christian. And if you're in a place in the South where everybody's a Christian, you happen to be a Jew, then respect that tradition, but you have a freedom to be who you are. That's the model I would advocate. Rather than scouring out the religious values in the name of some secular neutrality, which creates hostility to every religious form except atheism, which establishes atheism as a religion. So that's my posture. A friendly, distinct cooperation between church and state. And by the way, that is what's going on right now in the American electorate. We are having an opportunity to rediscover the faith-based initiatives. There's this Charitable Choice Act that was signed into law by President Clinton that says churches can now take federal monies and do the work of compassion and be who they are, as long as what they are doing with that money is for the civil good, even though they are an organization of faith. Do you know why they're doing that? Because they discovered that the state cannot do anything of value. It does not create value. But people of faith give themselves. And if they have resources to go with it, they have a far greater impact. So one of the great issues that's been on both sides, it's been Governor Bush and also Senator Lieberman, both who have been very outspoken on behalf of faith-based initiatives. And I think they are critical opportunities of rediscovering what I would call the friendly relationship between church and state. Still very different, but cooperating side by side against crime, against illiteracy, against family decay, against drug abuse, etc. So that would be my mind. You want to follow up with that? I would say this. If I can't have George Bush as president, I'd like to have Senator Lieberman as president. But I probably can't get that, so I'll vote for Bush. I have to vote yet. first of all, it's important to realize that the phrase separation of church and state is not in the American Constitution at all. It says there will be no law for the establishment of religion or any abridgment of the free exercise thereof. So it does not say anything about it. That phrase comes out of a letter that Jefferson wrote to a group of Baptists who had heard that the Congregational Church was going to become the established church in America. They heard a rumor there's going to be an attempt to do that. And in that letter Jefferson wrote, he said that there should be a wall of separation between church and state. He was assuring Baptist people that you're not going to be cut out of government by an established religion, a denomination. That was never used in constitutional inquiry until the great discussion of whether the Mormons could have a state that had polygamy. And they said, you know, there is a point where we have to understand their distinct church and state. And then it was picked up in the Everson case, I think in 1948, and a few other issues. And then now it is in the Constitution in terms of legal reasoning, but those words never were there. So the separation of church and state, as far as I know, has only been historically in one constitution, and that's the Constitution of the former USSR. It's not in the American Constitution. It says, free exercise, no abridgment. Okay, that's very different than the separation of church and state. So that's been a reading into the Constitution of a Jeffersonian metaphor. And I think it's significant that we keep that in mind. So as like I said, we don't have to use the word separation of church and state. That's only one regime of the Supreme Court speaking. You know, another regime can redefine it, and I hope they do. I hope they come more to the idea of a cooperation of church and state that are distinct, more of a Kuiperian sphere sovereignty, where we both have reason to work together, but we are different, so that we can operate in both for the well-being of all. Okay, well, I have to come back first. My biblical duty is to say, theoretically, I want to have a government where the faith can operate freely. Let's put it this way. Paul says, pray so that the faith might go forth. That's why you pray for governors, so that the faith might expand. So that's the kind of government we need, as we're... So now, on the other hand, the Scriptures also teach us to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So we have to give to Caesar our taxation, give custom to whom custom, tribute to whom tribute. You pay taxes for conscience sake. You have to pay them. You may not like where they're going, but that is your duty. And I suppose everyone does have the right finally to say, I'm not paying my taxes. But Peter says if you suffer persecution for that, then you have to take it. So if you say, I'm not giving any more tax money because it's going for abortions or it's going for the established atheism, you have a right to do that. But don't complain when you are persecuted. The Lord says, you know, that's the consequence for standing here. But the Bible says pay taxes. That's your duty. So, you know, and Rome was not a just state as far as I can see. But that's still our duty to pay that. And there may come a point, though, in conscience you may have to flee or you may have to resist because you do have to render unto God the things that are God. But as long as you can give to Caesar in good conscience, you need to do it. If you don't, then get ready to pay the consequences and do so joyfully as an expression of your faith in Christ. Okay, yes. Well, I would say, first of all, that a private citizen is neither the church nor the state. So, and we operate in both kingdoms all the time. That's why Jesus said, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God's what's God's. You have to do both. It's not an option to choose one or the other. You have to submit to both kingdoms, the spiritual kingdom of Christ, the political kingdom in which God in His providence has placed you. You have a duty to both. So at that point, then, a private citizen is able to say, well, Paul says the governor, the magistrate, does not bear the sword in vain. He is a minister of God. So you can serve God with the coercive power of state. Paul says that in Romans 13. I think it's interesting also that as you look at history, as you look at Hebrews 11, for example, it talks about how Joshua and others fought battles in faith. They actually went into military issues and conquered in faith. They were fighting war in faith. So the notion that you can exercise your faith in civil government is grounded in the Scriptures. Okay, that means, though, that you have a difficult calling at times when you're asked to do something that's inconsistent with your conscience. Let me give you a good example of this. Okay, this is an anecdote from someone I know. There's a lady that served as a state representative in Delaware who's a very fine Christian woman. And she was in the government, and there was a huge referendum going on I think it was gambling in the state of Delaware. Maybe it was on horse races or something like that, or maybe it was just the lottery or whatever. And there was this huge jockeying of who was, and she had never been asked. And the person who was governor at the time, I think, was Pierre DuPont, who actually ran for president later. And the day for the big vote came, and it was divided 50-50. And this friend of mine was there, and the governor turned to her in the debate and said, "You have to cast the deciding vote." And that was his strategy, was to cause her to be so embarrassed publicly that she would have to capitulate under what she knew what the governor wanted and what the state was. And she said at that moment, as a Christian, I knew I could not vote for anything that would cause the decay of the family. She said, I refuse to vote for that. I don't care what it costs me. Now, there was an example of a believer being at a place where she cast a vote that changed history, at least for the foreseeable future at that point. She said, no, it's not going to happen here. One vote. And she's a believer, and she voted her conscience. And it kept gambling from entering into the state of Delaware. She was a private citizen reflecting her spiritual value. And we are called to do that. You know, I think Daniel served in civil government in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, in the court of Darius and the others, Belteshazzar. You know, there he was. He's in place of power. He used his government. So did Joseph. And I think the fact that Paul would appeal to the Roman law to protect himself, there's nothing in the Bible that says you cannot be in civil government as a Christian. In fact, I say exactly the opposite. The danger that we have today is that Christians have fallen into the Anabaptist model of saying, I can't do this, it's too dirty. It's got to be the other way. It's a dirty business. That's why it needs the salt and light to clean it up. If you use that model in missions, I'm not going to that pagan land because they're all lost. I don't want to get defiled. How would that work? Well, why do we do that with government? The government is a mission field. God needs people who are theologically astute with a Christian worldview to enter into the sphere where they can exercise their government. Now, that may not be the calling of any of us here, but those that you educate and pastor and counsel and nurture, you need to say, don't be afraid to enter into that leadership sphere, but keep the lordship of Christ before you to the extent you possibly can. Can you do perfectly? No. Okay? But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. So I give many other examples of people who have cast a key vote at the right time and have changed the direction of history. One other one, since we're almost up, let me give you, I don't know if George W. Bush will be elected as president today. I have no idea. If he is elected, it'll be only the second time in history where a son has followed his father as a president of the United States. You may remember John Adams, who was pretty much kind of almost a deist, not quite. He was still kind of in the Christian providential, kind of a liberal. But his son, John Quincy Adams, was a thoroughgoing evangelical. He's one of the most Christian of presidents we ever had. He wrote letters to his father saying, Dad, Mom, what are you doing? You got to believe in the Trinity. This is biblical. You know, he was evangelizing his parents. By the way, he was the ambassador to Russia at the age of 13. Think about that. This is how well-educated he was. 13-year-old, he represented the United States in international government. A brilliant man. He's one of the few presidents that continued to serve in government after he was president. He was elected as a congressman. And I don't know if you, I've forgotten the name of the movie that of the slaves that were on trial. Did anybody see that? What is it?
Amistad.
Yeah, Amistad. That's a must-see movie because it shows John Quincy Adams at his best as a slumbering old congressman, former president, who only wakes up when there's a key vote. It's just like presbytery meetings. It's amazing. Yeah. Okay. Slumber, it's my issue here. The reason he did not leave is he said, I'm never going to leave government as long as the gag order is in place that says you cannot talk about slavery. He said, I'm going to die in the Senate, die in the Congress if I have to, but I'm going to stand here and I'm going to fight it every chance I have to get up and say we can debate this issue. Do you know why there's no slavery in America? Because a doting old Christian former president who should have retired didn't retire and say, I'm going to fight this injustice until I die. And he fought the battle that finally ended the gag rule. He fought it with everything he had. And it's in that debate that created the open discussion that said slavery is immoral. By the way, America is not a perfect nation. We sin profoundly in slavery. We must repent. We're still repenting over it. It's a travesty, a tragedy. And that's part of our national shame. What we've done to the Native Americans is a shame. I'm not saying America right in everything we've done. I'm saying America has a spiritual heritage that we shouldn't forget. And John Quincy Adams was one of those men who said, I'm not giving up because there's a moral issue. And we need that dogged determination. Can I tell you what the issue of our day is? It's the sanctity of life. If we don't speak up and act and vote and serve, your neighbors are going to be having their 30-day-old babies put to death because they said they're not worth living. That's just around the corner. That's what Peter Singer's arguing at Princeton. Another 20 years, that will be the law of the land unless you have the courage to say it is unjust to kill a life at any stage in development. The greatest issue facing America is the sanctity of life, and that's why this election is such a key thing. I hope if Bush is elected, he has the courage to do what he said he would do, which is to make sure that life is honored in his appointments to the court. If he does not, the day will come. And you remember my words. You heard it here at Westminster Seminary by an adjunct professor of history. We will be killing 30-day-old babies and saying it's you're a woman and family's right to choose. That will happen. I guarantee you it will happen. Over $30 million of money have been put into that chair at Princeton to advocate that view, to have scholars writing papers that will be disseminated across the country so that when that case gets to the Supreme Court, they can say public policy is now being argued by many intellectual centers that we can't impose Christian values on life that's been born. In the ancient Roman world, they used to allow infants that were unacceptable to live to die. It'll happen, I guarantee you. Are you salt? Are you light? Do you have any courage? Do you believe anything? I'm in ethics now, I know that. But this is an ethical principle that is part of what Westminster has been willing to stand for and say life is sacred. And that is an issue that calls forth God's people to speak out. Okay, we need to conclude. Thanks.